Hello, this is Chris Yerkes reading to you from the October 23rd edition of the County Chronicle. We'll start with the first page stories. Arthur School Board. Arthur School Board discusses referendum by Ariana Cherry. The Arthur CUSD No. 305 Board of Education met at the Atwood Grade School on Wednesday, October 16th. Superintendent Shannon Cheek provided an update on the district's facilities and referendum, which will be on the ballot for the upcoming November 5th election. Cheek informed the board that there will be one more open house to present information about the referendum and answer any questions. He noted that the previous open house had a good turnout with many new faces in attendance. Cheek expressed appreciation for those who showed up to ask questions in person rather than resorting to social media. Cheek has been actively speaking about the referendum at various venues throughout the district. He emphasized the importance of spending time engaging with the community and answering their questions. It has been time well spent, he stated. Cheek announced a few more upcoming dates for public engagement related to the referendum. On Sunday, October 27th, he'll be at the Atwood First Baptist Church at 2 p.m. and the Vine Street Christian Church in Arthur at 4 p.m. to discuss the referendum and answer questions. He was in Lovington on October 20th for the same purpose. Cheek also highlighted the district's website, which includes a dedicated section for the referendum. The website features frequently asked questions and other information to help voters make informed decisions. Cheek thanked Amanda Romine for efforts in putting together the website. Thanks to Amanda Romine for putting it together. I feel like it's really good. It has nice rendering and a great video. Directing people there has been very helpfully commended. Shannon Cheek also presented a show on the district's podcast, The Tonight Show, where he presented Damian Schlitt from BLDD and Beth Wiley, president of the Board of Education. They spoke about the building project and how I'll be helping students in the district. Cheek also recognized the outstanding work of the Vote Yes Committee, which has been actively organizing and advocating for the referendum in the community. Cheek expressed pride in the district's leadership team and their commitment to focusing on the needs of the district's students. I'm very proud of our district, and we have used every avenue to talk about the referendum. I'm proud of the leadership team that we have here, forward-thinking and proud to be with a group that is focused on kids, Cheek said. The school board superintendent Cheek, the Vote Yes committee, and many others have been doing their best to provide transparency and participate in community engagement, which has been essential for voters to ensure that they have the knowledge that they need to make an informed decision on November 5th. In other news, the board approved two donations totaling $550 to the district. One donation was for the amount of $450 from Fred and Laura Peralta, and another was an anonymous donation of $100 to the Atwood Hammond Grade School PBS Knights Buck store. The board also approved the district's risk management plan. ALAH High School Principal Stephanie Siegmeier presented high school student Rialyn Slaughter, who has been named a commended student in the 2025 National Merit Scholarship Program. Personnel report, certified. Accepted certified staff member required to require letter. Extracurricular approved hiring Hannah Morphy as the high school girls basketball assistant. Approved Alexa Miller as volunteer high school girls basketball assistant. The next article, Tuscola City Council expands number of Class A liquor licenses by David Porter. There are dozens of places to buy liquor in Tuscola, and there soon will be a few more. At the request of Mayor Dan Kleiss, the City Council expanded the number of Class A liquor licenses to 15 on Tuesday, October 15th. Kleiss said the number of licenses were maxed out, and there have been a couple of recent applications for licenses. When asked if the Class A license was for more restaurants, Kleiss explained that it's basically anything. It is the most permissive class of liquor licenses in the city and allows for the sale of packaged liquor to go and alcohol to be consumed on site. Licenses cost $1,000 per year, according to the city's website. Kleiss said there are pending applications from the Breakfast Place and American Dining, which is where Tacarbon had been, as well as for the building that most recently housed Paddy Wagon Antiques, known as the DMED Discount Building, by longtime residents. Kleiss said the building will be a liquor store. The council approved the request to increase the number of liquor licenses with no further discussion. The council also approved the purchase of 8 sets of turnout gear for the fire department, despite the price being more than twice what had been budgeted. Turnout gear, or bunker gear, is mostly protective clothing worn by firefighters. Air One Equipment is the company providing the gear for $26,000. The city had budgeted $12,500. Kleiss said the higher cost was not surprising to him. Insurance costs for the city also went up by 4%. The council approved the renewal rate of $123,000 with IMLRMA, Illinois Municipal League Risk Management Association. City Administrator Drew Howell said the cost includes a discount for early payment and annual dues to the Municipal League. The consent agenda included two payment requests, $104,000 to B&D Drainage for the NC Street Water Main Project and $53,000 to LJ Swingler & Sons for renovation at the police department. Also approved in the consent agenda was the route for the Run for Nash 5K Saturday, October 26th at Irvin Park. The next article comes from the Douglas County Board, allocates nearly $3 million towards Springfield Road by Ben Crane. The Douglas County Board approved a sum of $2,700,000 of motor fuel tax funds for the construction and resurfacing of Springfield Road on Wednesday, pushing to total package sum past $6 million. The project plans to renovate the 4.25-mile stretch of highway 2 miles south of Arthur. According to County Engineer Jim Crane, the project will go out to bid within the next month and will begin in the springtime of next year. The board also appointed four drainage district trustees, including Tamara S. Herrick for the Brushy Fork Drainage District 1964L712, Philip Jacob Craig for the Drainage District No. 13 of Tuscola and Arcola, 1964L10039, John H. Schrock for the Drainage District No. 5 of Bourbon, 1964L9281, and Larry Hirschberger for the Mast Union Drainage District No. 1 of Low and Jonathan Creek, 2013MC1. Rachel Stenger, representative from the Moultrie Douglas County Youth 4-H, also gave a presentation to the board meeting and update on the happenings within the club. She reported that the club continues to see growth as they continue to provide opportunities for local youth. "I have love for youth and a passion for 4-H," she said. There are around 15 members of the public in attendance in reaction to the firing of Douglas County Animal Shelter Director Spencer Hall, with many voicing their displeasure. For their comments as well as the full story, please see the article located in the front page of this week's edition. An article from the Arcola City Council begins payment of Libman truck route by Ben Crane. The Arcola City Council approved the first pay request for the Libman truck route amounting to $433,000 at Monday's meeting, among other items on the agenda. The council also approved Resolution 24R9, which pulls $160,000 of TIF No. 1 and Business District funds each for a water main extension and replacement project. Resolution 24R10, which simply is the annual general assistance agreement with Coles County Regional Planning, was also approved. CCRP will charge the city $43 per hour per contract. "They help out with things that are out of our skills and scope," said City Administrator Bill Wagoner. Ordinance 24S12, which is an ordinance amending a business district facade agreement with Dale and Bonnie Yoder, stipulates the city will pay the lesser of 50% of the total cost, or half of $15,000, for their project. Ordinance 24S13, with a Hispanic and American grocery store, is similar, which is the lesser of 50% of the total cost, or half of $20,000, the city has allocated to the resurfacing of the parking lot. Ordinance 24S14 was approved by the council as well, which was an ordinance approving and authorizing the execution of a business district redevelopment agreement between the city and Auto Real Estate. In short, the city is buying a parcel of land behind the Dairy Queen for $250,000 from Auto, which the city will pay over time. Paul Goodwin was also awarded a 50-cent raise to his hourly rate up to $24.25 per hour for completing his sewer operator license. Finally, David Garcia Tovar was approved to be full-time employee by the council. There's a front-page article, "Confusion, Controversy Surrounding Termination of Animal Shelter Director" by Ben Crane. In a move that has caused public outrage, Spencer Hall, the director of the Douglas County Animal Shelter, has been terminated from her position, sparking outrage and a flurry of questions. "Can you just tell us what is going on?" said one member of the public in attendance at the Douglas County Board meeting Wednesday. Around 20 members of the public were in attendance, with many sharing their disbelief at the termination as well as applauding other attendees after they spoke. "It is deplorable and unprofessional the way this board has handled the situation with Spencer," said one attendee. "She loves this community. We trust her," said another. Chairman Tom Hettinger was visibly smirking during the entirety of the discussion, causing more frustration from the crowd. A member of the crowd asked if the board cares about animals. "We do, and we do what the best we can," replied Hettinger. "Because of the nature of the termination, the board legally does not have to make any discussion or minutes of an executive session available to the public." In an exclusive interview, Hall recounted the series of events that led to her suspension and eventual dismissal by the county board. At the heart of the matter was a court-ordered return of four dogs to a suspected animal abuser, Luther Clark, a decision that Hall vehemently opposed, driven by her unwavering commitment to the welfare of the animals in her care. I was more worried about what he was going to do to those dogs, Hall said, her voice tinged with frustration. I didn't want them to go backwards. They were happy and loving, and I didn't want that to change. Despite her objections, Hall described the tense confrontation that unfolded as Douglas County Sheriff's Office deputies arrived at the shelter to relieve the dogs, citing a court order. Hall attempted to prevent the transfer of the dogs, particularly those who were on heartworm positive, fearing they would not receive the necessary treatment. I said, no, he's not getting the ones that are heartworm positive because they will not get treatment and they're going to die, Hall recounted. And then the cop said, it's a court order, Spencer. He will get whichever court he wants. You have to unlock this gate or we will arrest you. Reluctantly, Hall unlocked the gate, allowing the deputies to take the dogs. This incident, however, would prove to be the catalyst for her termination. In the days that followed, Hall received an email stating that the county board would be holding an executive session to discuss her punishment for not releasing the dogs in a timely manner. This left Hall confused, as she believed she had acted within the appropriate time frame, a sentiment echoed by those who witnessed the events unfold. I was very confused. There was going to be a talk about my punishment for not releasing the dogs in a timely manner, which I was confused because I had released the dogs in a timely manner, Hall said. During the executive session, Hall was informed that she was being suspended indefinitely with a special hearing to be held regarding her future. The decision to terminate, she believes, was influenced by tensions with certain board members, a dynamic that's been simmering for some time. It's important to note that the Animal Control Committee consists of three voting members, Ed Carlton, Dan Henry, and Bibby Appleby. The special hearing was conducted without Henry, who had a pre-planned vacation. As chairman, Hettinger stepped in as a voting member. Hall believes that if Henry had been there to vote, she would not have been terminated. I already knew that one of the board members didn't like me, so I figured something was going to happen, Hall said. The termination has sparked a wave of public support for Hall, with a petition garnering over 600 signatures calling for her reinstatement. Many in the community have expressed their outrage at the board's decision, citing Hall's unwavering dedication to the welfare of the animals in her care and the significant improvement she has made to the shelter during her tenure. You have a man that was there for 10 to 15 years that got terminated that didn't have something like this. I was a manager for 1 year, and I have almost 600 people that signed that petition to get me back. That's how much I have done in the shelter in just a year, Hall said. State's attorney Robert Kozik offered some insight from the county's perspective. We're in the process of finding a replacement head for the shelter, which I understand is expected to happen within the next week. It is currently staffed. The dogs are currently being cared for and let out and fed, and everything that would be expected. So the shelter is currently operating and staffed. There is an expectation that a new head will be appointed within the next week and another employee being hired very soon. Kozik was not willing to offer any response to any of the backlash the county has received in its decision to terminate Hall and motion to allow Clark to retrieve some of the dogs. However, Kozik said the County Chronicle that the decision was influenced by the circumstantial evidence presented surrounding the case. As Hall prepares to pursue a wrongful termination lawsuit, the future of the animal shelter and the well-being of the animals remains uncertain. And the final first-page story, Taxing Bodies Come Together to Debate the Future of Tax Increment Financing by Ben Crane. The future of Arcola's tax increment financing, TIF, districts took a center stage at a recent public meeting as local officials and community members engaged in a nuanced and at times contentious discussion on how to best leverage these economic development tools to spur growth and address pressing needs. There's an intricate web of competing interests and priorities that Arcola must navigate as it charts a path forward, a delicate balancing act between supporting the community's long-term viability and addressing the fiscal concerns of various taxing bodies. Adam Strout of PGAV Planners acted as mediator of the discussion. At the heart of the debate was the use of TIF funds for residential development. Tom Mulligan, superintendent of the Arcola School District, argued that new housing is critical to supporting the community's future, citing a concerning decline in student enrollment over the last decade. If we don't do anything from a residential growth standpoint and the TIF sunsets, I think this community could be in some real challenges from school sustainability standpoint, Mulligan said. Mulligan emphasized the symbiotic relations between the school district and the broader community, warning that if Arcola fails to address its housing needs, the school district could face significant challenges that would ultimately undermine the entire community. I think if we don't work together and have some sort of a plan on growing housing and expanding our base of people in the community, I think the school district is going to struggle moving forward, Mulligan said. However, Deanna Shields, representing the Arcola Township, expressed reservations about using TIF for housing, citing the intergovernmental agreement that prohibits such use. She suggested alternative approaches, such as the school district offering tax abatements to incentivize residential development. Shields' concern highlighted the complex fiscal realities facing the township, which relies heavily on property tax revenue to fund its operations. The township, she argued, is already maxed out in terms of its ability to generate revenue, and any growth in the community that does not directly benefit the township could further strain its resources. Mark Nackey, representing the Road District, argued that Libman would expand with or without TIF and that the bodies need to reconsider what goes in and what stays out of the districts. Brian Moody, representing Douglas County, acknowledged the township's concern but emphasized the importance of finding a collaborative solution that addresses the needs of all stakeholders. I think generally you want to expand the tax base. You want to continue to see growth, and you think you're focused on the right areas, Moody said. You know, I understand the concern, the thinking, hey, it's a big company, it's making a lot of money. You know, everything in context. Moody suggested the use of TIF for infrastructure development would be a key tool in supporting residential growth, as the high upfront costs of building roads and utilities often serves as a barrier for development. The discussion also touched on the potential impact of Cronus, a major fertilizer plant coming to Douglas County, and the need to prepare for the influx of new workers and their housing needs. Bill Wagoner, representing the city of Arcola, noted that the conditions have changed since the TIF districts were first established, and the city is exploring options to close out its TIFs 1 and 6 while potentially using TIF as a tool to support downtown revitalization and infrastructure for residential development. Underlying the debate was a recognition of the complex and often competing interests at play when it comes to TIF districts. The meeting highlighted the delicate balance Arcola must strike as it seeks to leverage TIF to drive growth and economic development while also addressing the fiscal concerns of various taxing bodies and the broader community needs. I really appreciate the township and them coming to be a part of the discussion tonight, Mulligan said. I was really glad to hear that they definitely are not generally opposed to the growth of the community and housing. It was a real positive thing. I think we heard from them that there's some financial things that they're concerned about. Hopefully we can have some more conversations and we could sit down and find out exactly maybe what those are. And we can come up with some agreement too, really, so we can all work together. There are many different concerns, needs, and ideas that need to be sorted through as the taxing bodies move forward with their discussions. As Moody put it, the taxing bodies look to find a win-win solution regarding the future of TIF. We'll move now to the obituaries. Leanne Schrock, 83 of Arthur, passed away at 8:20 a.m. on Friday, October 18, 2024, at Sarah Bush Lincoln Health Center in Mattoon, Illinois. Visitation will be held from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. and from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. on Sunday, October 20th at the Sunnyside Mennonite Church, 477 Illinois 133, Arcola, Illinois, and from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. on Monday, October 21st at the church. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. on Monday, October 21st at the Sunnyside Mennonite Church. Pastor Larry Rock will officiate. The Edward Funeral Home is assisting with arrangements. Beatrice L. Zuhon, age 93 of Charleston, passed away Friday evening, October 18th, at the Arthur Home in Arthur, Illinois. A funeral service in her honor will be held at 11:30 a.m. Wednesday, October 23rd, at St. Paul's Lutheran Church, 8975 East County Road, 1200 North, Mattoon, Illinois. Reverend Dan Ulrich will officiate. A committal service will immediately follow in Humboldt Cemetery in Humboldt. The visitation will be held the same day from 10 a.m. until the day time of the service at the church. Mitchell Jurgen Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. Jennifer Joan Wickersham, 51 of Pensacola, Florida, formerly of Hiawassee, Georgia, passed away at 11:44 a.m. Wednesday, October 16th at her residence. Visitation will be held from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. on Saturday, October 26th at the Edwards Funeral Home, 221 East Main Street, Arcola, Illinois. Funeral services will be held at 1 p.m. on Sunday, October 27th at the Edwards Funeral Home in Arcola, Illinois. Burial with military honors will follow in the Humboldt Cemetery in Humboldt. Richard G. Dick Bradford, 95 of Arthur, died at 3:08 p.m. Friday, October 18th at the Sarah Bush Lincoln Hospital in Mattoon. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Tuesday, October 22nd at the Arthur United Methodist Church with Pastor Jill Bunker officiating. Casual dress is requested. Burial will follow. in the Arthur Cemetery. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to the funeral service at the church. Schrader Funeral Home is assisting the family with arrangements. Maymay Foreman, 70 of Tuscola, formerly of Villa Grove, passed away peacefully on Wednesday, October 2, 2024 at Carl Hospital in Urbana. A celebration of Maymay's life will be held on Saturday, November 2, 2024 from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. at the Joins Funeral Home in Villa Grove. An article, ATI Physical Therapy Opens Its Doors in Tuscola, Donates to Local Family, by Ben Crane. ATI Physical Therapy held their grand opening on Main Street in Tuscola, while their foundation also making a $7,500 donation to a family in need. It means a lot because this company, particularly here in Tuscola, knows us very well, and they know Aaron very well, and they hear the needs and the struggles that we have, Autumn Tainer said. Her 11-year-old daughter, Erin, has special needs, and the money will be used for a new bed, bathroom modifications, and other necessities that aren't covered by their insurance, including diapers and clothing. Taylor described the donation making a huge impact in addressing the family's significant financial needs and challenges. The ATI Foundation awards contributions to families through nominations from their employees and individuals and families who are not even in need to be connected to ATI at all. We can essentially support any person through an individual group, and typically an ATI employee will refer the family, ATI Foundation Director Shelley Maxwell said. The selection of a recipient is organized to be fair and unbiased, with a blind review committee and a board of directors determining the amount of funding. Maxwell preached the mission of the foundation on the basis of lack of accessibility for rural communities. She also noted that a majority of ATI employees are original to where the location is. With over 1,000 locations across the country, ATI looks to continue to be impactful within the communities that they serve. The next article, longtime Douglas County Museum Director departs for new role at Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library, by Ben Crane. After a decade of work, Anna Dvorak is leaving her position as director of the Douglas County Museum to take on a new challenge as registrar for the 3D collection at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum in Springfield. Dvorak, a Wisconsin native, first came to Douglas County area in 2012 after earning her master's degree in critical and curatorial studies from the University of Louisville. She was drawn to the opportunity to build up the fledgling museum, which had struggled with leadership and funding issues in the years prior to her arrival. It was a real challenge, but also an exciting one, Dvorak reflected. The museum had fallen into disrepair, and parts of the collection were even sold off. But I saw a lot of potential, and the community was really eager to preserve its local history. Under Dvorak's guidance, the museum underwent a transformation. She worked tirelessly to catalog and preserve the collection, securing a small tax base through voter-approved referendum that allowed the museum to maintain its facilities and operations. Dvorak also spearheaded the creation of new exhibits and programs that brought the community's rich history to life, including a focus on highlighting diverse voices and perspectives. When I first came here, there was a women's work exhibit that really rubbed me the wrong way, Dvorak explained. It was very one-dimensional and didn't do justice to the important contribution of women in the community. I knew we needed to do better telling the full story of local history. Dvorak's efforts to revitalize the museum and engage the community did not go unnoticed. Dan Kleiss, mayor of Tuscola, spoke to her efforts. First of all, it's great for her that she's taken a new role over to Springfield. She's really done a good job, and I think she was a very good asset to this museum as well, said Mayor Kleiss. While Dvorak is excited about the new chapter of her career, she admits that leaving the museum and the people she's worked with for over the past decade will be bittersweet. This place has become like a second home to me, she said. The volunteers and board members are more like family, but I'm also ready for a new challenge, and I'm really looking forward to working with the incredible collection at the Lincoln Library. In her new role as registrar, Dvorak will be responsible for managing the museum's 3D artifacts, including overseeing the cataloging, storage, and care of these important historical objects. She will also collaborate with other departments to ensure the collection is properly maintained and accessible to researchers and the public. This museum is so much more than just a building, she said. It's a place where people can connect with their history, celebrate their heritage, and feel a sense of pride in where they came from. That's what I've always tried to foster, and I hope the new director will continue that important work. Dvorak's departure from the Douglas County Museum marks the end of an era, but her legacy will undoubtedly continue to shape the institution and the community it serves. She takes on her new role in Springfield. Dvorak's passion for preserving and sharing local history will undoubtedly continue to shine. Another article, Seniors to Feel Effective Inflation Reduction Act During Medicare Annual Enrollment Period. With the Medicare Annual Enrollment Period, AEP, just around the corner, First Mid Insurance Group, FMIG, wants to educate seniors during this important time of year. The AEP represents the period between October 15th to December 9th when people can make changes to their current Medicare coverage. Mike Herm, head of Senior Solutions Division at FMIG, said that with the Inflation Reduction Act coming into full effect in 2025, he expects that over half of Medicare customers will need to make additional judgments to their coverage. First Mid Insurance Group is poised to help assist seniors with navigating these complex Medicare changes. FMIG Senior Solution handles many different aspects of insurance for seniors, including Medicare supplements, Medicare Advantage plans, Medicare Part D plans, long-term care insurance, life insurance, cancer insurance, and annuities. The Inflation Reduction Act will allow Medicare to negotiate the price for certain drugs, making some more affordable for certain Medicare users. The new laws will affect customers in a variety of ways, and the Senior Solutions team works with customers to educate them on their options. This year, we expect to engage with three times as many customers, helping them proactively make any necessary changes, Herm said. We'll meet with many customers who want face-to-face interaction, either in our office or at their home. For those who prefer a more efficient process, we can talk over the phone or via web meetings. We enjoy these discussions and work together to tailor the best plans for everyone. We've been doing this since 1979, so we have extensive experience and work with most of the competitive insurance carriers available in the area we serve, especially in Illinois, Missouri, and Wisconsin. FMIG Senior Solutions works with seniors throughout the year, not just during the AEP timeframe. Herm said his team discusses many topics with customers at or near retirement around the age of 65, including Medicare, the extra cost of critical illness or cancer, asset protection, including life insurance and annuities, rehabilitation, and final expense coverage. After relying on their parents for insurance when they were kids and then employers for their insurance during their careers, this time period for seniors can be really stressful when they have many of these decisions to make on their own, Herm said. We educate them on a variety of ways. To sign up for Medicare, you must go through the Social Security office. We teach them how to navigate that task, whether online, in person, or over the phone. We also provide public education, such as lunch and learns for employers and their employees. Insurance can be an extremely complicated topic, and people need to be educated on all the possible options. Consultative services and education are a big part of what we do. Another article, Recent Farm Accidents Alerts Safety Experts, by Phyllis Coulter of FarmWeek. Already this harvest season, grain entrapments, utility task vehicles, UTV crashes, and other farm accidents have reported across the state. RFD Radio Network talked to farm safety specialists to get relevant safety tips. UTV vehicles. We're seeing more and more UTV accidents, said Amy Rademacher, farm safety specialist with Rademacher Agricultural Safety and Health Services. There are seatbelts in there for a reason. UTVs are being used at times as substitute for cars and trucks, but they don't provide the same protection for drivers and passengers, including airbags. UTVs are not designed for joyrides, but for practical purposes getting back and forth to the field and carrying tools, she said. She encouraged both UTVs and recreational all-terrain vehicles, ATVs, to be operated only by age-appropriate drivers. Grain entrapment. This time of year, flowing grain is particularly dangerous. Important not to be in the grain bin or vehicle when it is being loaded or unloaded, the safety specialist said. It only takes a second to get into a situation where you need to call for help, she said. Rademacher reminds farmers to use lifeline, harness, a spotter, and belay systems when working in bins and not to enter a bin when grain is moving. She also cautioned against letting children play in grain like a sandbox. It can send a mixed message. They might not be able to differentiate between when it's safe to play in grain. We never want them to be in a wagon and bins, she said. Electrical safety. Electricity is sometimes something a person can't see or smell or hear. Someone can become complacent, she said. In the fields, farmers need to be cautious around overhead power lines, especially when loading and unloading with augers. Rademacher said a farmer's job is to think of the safety of people working with them. Make sure there are no augers anywhere within 10 feet of those power lines. Look for the safest place to unload semis and wagons when transporting the equipment. And that is all we have time for today. This is Chris Yerkes saying goodbye and see you again next week.